Hello and welcome to the Alts Nerd Show. Independent, you know, all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. This is the show where we talk about everything else in the world of nerd culture. I'm Gregor Sprague, and joining me as always is Corey Scott. Corey, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, man. How are you doing this week?
I'm doing pretty good. And joining us is, at least for the first news story, is one of our producers, Beatmaster, who, because we are going to talk a little bit about the news that happened over the week. The past week that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is leaving the Sandman movie citing creative differences. So it looks like it's just a thing of New Line sucks.
I don't know that it's New Line sucks. Certainly not. If you look at New Line's schedule coming up and the things they've done in the past, they've had some good hits. Creed is one of New Line Cinema's productions. The Shazam movie that's coming out in 2019 is a New Line thing. We have no idea what that's going to be like other than the fact that Dwayne Johnson's in it. They have done the Lord of the Rings movies, including the Hobbit movies. They kind of go back and forth, like any company.
Lord of the Rings is one of the... hold on, actually, let me pull it up. As one of the people in their accounting has said that the Lord of the Rings film trilogy is their biggest loss, or they made a horrendous loss on the movies.
On the Hobbit films, or no, on the Lord of the Rings?
Lord of the Rings film trilogy.
That's some bullshit, because those movies did great, so that's some creative fucking accounting bullshit that doesn't count. That's like toilets costing $600 when you sell them to the military versus anybody else. I don't trust the books.
And are we talking about the same New Line Cinemas here that has, or that had, or has 15 actors suing them, claiming that they have never received their 5% of revenue from the merchandise sold in relation to the movie which contains their likeness? Or the same, and this one's my favorite one, the same New Line Cinemas that Peter Jackson's company, Wingnut Films, questioned their accounting methods, brought in an outside auditor which was allowed in their contracts, and then they sued New Line, and New Line executive Robert Shea took great offense, declaring that they would never work with Peter Jackson again.
Okay, so if you're talking about New Line Cinema sucks because New Line Cinema is basically a crap fest as far as their accounting and payments, sure. That's not what I was understanding from the story. All I heard was creative differences. But no, that makes a good bit of sense then. That is news to me. Maybe post a link to that in the show notes, you dick cheese. But otherwise, it's just a company. It's a company that I thought, from the way that it sounded like JJO was talking about it, is that New Line Cinema wanted to go a different way with the movie versus what he was trying to do with the movie, which I would assume, and Beatmaster, you can get in on this, was he was trying to go with something that fits the tone of the sort of maybe the fantasy, the literature kind of feel to it of what Sandman was, whereas New Line Cinema, I presume, wanted to look at it more as a horror genre film.
Yeah, the thing is with New Line Cinema, you got a company maybe now in its current form after they had various changes in their structure, that they are looking for something that they can sell. And as they are also known as for many horror movies, I'm worried that they're going to change their direction in a way that is near to them, that they know better than the fantasy itself. Because Lord of the Rings was all Peter Jackson and not them. They just put in the money for this and sometimes even not that. So I think more that we are in danger of seeing a character that we know in a story that is completed in 75 issues that we can't expect to have that replicated. So what can we expect exactly from a Sandman movie or TV show, whatever comes first? What can we reasonably expect under these circumstances? Now with the new writer that we have in for Final Destination 5, not a known name, but I didn't know the Russo brothers beforehand, so we can always be surprised. But who's going to take the helms and put it the right way? I was hoping for something like Del Toro, because he can do fantasy and horror in a combination that is like its source material. But really, what can we expect? Where are we going with that whole brand? As Vertigo comes all together to them now, we have to see if we're going to get the influx of such things that can have a success, but under which circumstances? The way we want to see it as old geeks that saw it in the first runs, or remade for the new R-rated market that they're creating now everywhere?
I mean, realistically, Sandman should wind up in the R-rated side. It feels like Vertigo was the R-rated publisher for DC, and not R-rated because of graphic sex or even graphic violence, but just the themes of it, the mature themes. And there was some pretty heavy stuff in Sandman. The whole diner episode that was pretty horrifying, of the villain who went in there and just kind of took control of everybody. Very akin to what they used Kilgrave with in Jessica Jones. I can see the sparks of that as something that's interesting to someone who makes horror films. The other thing is that New Line seems to really like to do things that are going to continue, that are going to have multiple movies. They're doing a Journey 3, and the first Journey into the Center of the Earth film came out at least like 8 years ago. It seems like it might even be longer than that. It is a question as to if they're going to try to follow Gaiman's vision of it, or if they're just going to take the Sandman character and insert him into what is a stock script, essentially, and put it someplace where it's not going to really be about the source material as much as, well, we just think the character's cool and we're going to make it work. And I believe that even though we may have ideas as to how good a job Joseph Gordon-Levitt would have done with it, he at least seemed to have a pure love for the stories and for the literature. So he was a fan, and the question always becomes, are the fans the right people to make these movies? You know, you can argue that Snyder is a fan of comic books in the way that he made Watchmen and the way that 300 was made, but does his fandom equal out to be right for the films? I mean, if you're copying the page straight to the screen, sure, but when you go off and you tell your own stories, does it equal out to the same thing? You could have the same thing said about Del Toro. Del Toro did the Hellboy movies, and even though he didn't create them and the stories were brand new, Del Toro told stories that seemed 100% accurate to the Hellboy characters. At least to me, but I'm not a super fan. Like, other people may have looked at it differently. I know that Mignola has nothing but great things to say about Del Toro's visions in the films. But yeah, do they want to go with somebody who's beholden to what came from the comics, or do they want to go with somebody who's going to bring a new vision to it, or who's going to fit in the company line? And that's always tough to say until you see it happen.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I will add to this is a little bit of worry, but we're still early enough in the development of the movie to where I don't think it will happen. But with how everyone looks at Ant-Man, where, oh, you could see that these are the parts that Edgar Wright was involved in that he shot, and so wouldn't it have been cool if we had got to see the rest of his vision? I don't necessarily know if we'll have that, but I also don't want to see a network TVization of a Vertigo comic. Like, you look at, you look at iZombie, you look at Lucifer. Both of those are, I'm going to assume, especially even more so with Lucifer, I haven't read any of the books that he's in over at DC or over at Vertigo, but you read the iZombie comic and it is night and day different than the than the TV show.
Yeah.
Which is good. You know, it's it that to me helps differentiate, and you can, it makes it easier for people to go and read and find the iZombie comics. Then you look at Lucifer, where I saw the first 2-3 episodes of the TV
incredibly
show.
Incredibly different from anything that happened in the comics.
Yeah. And it's just like sort of like, oh hey, Lucifer comes, like, I'm gonna assume the main premise of it, like Lucifer coming up and being on vacation or something, is part of the comic. If not, my whole thing I was gonna say about it goes sort of flat.
He gave the keys to it to Sandman, and he passed it on to two angels, but that's a story on its own.
Yeah.
Worth exploring.
And so it's like, okay, you have, at the one side where it's like, okay, he has, like, he comes up and just sort of explores or whatever, and this one is like, oh, he decides to become a detective.
I mean, it's really funny how many Vertigo stories have to do with one of these entities going on vacation. The first death story that's done, Death, the Time of Your Life, Time of Your Life, was basically Death goes on vacation for a day, which is an old kind of mythic tale anyways. And then Lucifer gives up being the ruler of hell over in Preacher. God essentially quits being God for a while. So it's kind of hilarious that that is something that is repeated so much in these things. So maybe in that regard, it makes sense that these takes for TV would be different from the source material, just because maybe the source material wasn't as original as what we give it credit for. On the other hand, 1001 Procedurals isn't either. I would hate to see Sandman Solves Crimes as a weekly series come to you on TNT.
Oh, Jesus.
But, I mean, the problem is that we're kind of spoiled. Our expectations are really high now. Even on shows that are not fantastic examples of television, like Flash and Arrow and Supergirl, they're still really pretty good, and they are honest to what the ideas were of these characters. Arrow maybe not as much because they tried to make him more Batman-ish, but I think that they at least are honest that it's a comic book superhero show. When we look at the Netflix series that Marvel's done so far, they're stellar pieces of work and storytelling and production and acting, so much so that you look at the next things that are coming out, and even great shows like Agent Carter and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I love those shows, but they're not at the same level as what those Netflix shows are, so your expectation is now lifted even higher than it already was. It used to be that we got TV shows like Mantis, or the Street Hawk, or The Man from Atlantis, or My Secret Identity, stuff that was just kind of pablum that was barely superhero based. Now we're getting actual Marvel and DC properties on TV, and they're good shows, in some cases fantastic shows. So you want to see something that is already what was a pinnacle of comic books when it came out in the 90s, was one of the greatest tales of comics by one of the best creators and writers of comics and of literature in general for the modern day. You want to see it treated with such utmost respect, especially the years that we've been waiting for Sandman, or we've been waiting for Death, for these things to happen in film. And yeah, you've got a lot of worry. You've got a lot of trepidation. You see someone who obviously cares about it like a super fan, as JGL did, and then to see him not be there is already, it's filling you with a bit of dread. And that's too bad. But that doesn't mean that the person who's coming in isn't also going to have that love for it and want to give us something as great as possible. But we have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be fair, every writer would say he gave his utmost, and he's a fan of the material. You hear that any time from any writer or director that gets bought up. So I take that with a grain of salt. But
except for, you know, the guy who makes Fantastic Four,
Josh Trank,
who says this is just a piece of shit. And boy, was it. But I just, yeah, you know, I'm going to be hesitant until I see something of it. And we still have no idea how close it is to even really being made. You know, just because there's now another person attached to the project doesn't mean it gets any further than it already was. These things stagnate for years. That happens to so many comic people. It's like, oh yeah, we signed with this production company. We've gotten paid all this money that we can't talk about. We can't disclose anything about it, but it's in the works. 5 years later, well, that contract expired, so we're going to fish it out again and see what happens. And hopefully, you know, 5 years later, the comic has still got a relative fan base that another company might be interested in picking it up, but it goes downhill every year after that. So, yeah, I really want Sandman to get made, but I want it to get made right. And at this point in time, I'm far more excited about what's going on with American Gods as a TV series for Starz. Mm-hmm. Because they're doing something. And I think putting it on TV, the episodic nature of it, that would be ideal for Sandman. I understand why they say that it needs to be movies because it's so big. But 10 episodes of a great series on Netflix can feel that big. Can do the first two storylines, the first two trades of the series, if they wanted to go that route. So, I don't know. A movie is, it's got to be something outstanding to equal out to be what they want as far as a big hit in a movie with material that is, honestly, I think is going to go over a lot of people's heads. Not because people are dumb, but because it takes an investment. It takes an investment of time and imagination and kind of a love, and it's from a different time when stories were told differently, and trying to get today's audience to read and understand Sandman is difficult enough compared to what people were reading in the 90s. So trying to get them to watch the movie of it would be, I think, just as hard.
Yeah, seriously, but the thing is that I worry because of Deadpool's success that they're going to push out movies faster, fast-track them before looking at the product itself, if it's worth or not, and just push out the after another, killing the Vertigo possibility of great success.
But was Deadpool fast-tracked?
No, movies get fast-tracked because of it, I'm saying.
Right. No, I get what you're saying. And that's the thing is, we already know that it feels like people are getting the wrong messages from Deadpool succeeding. How much evidence of that are we really seeing? Is it because there's an R-rated cut of Batman v Superman? That seems like that was going to happen no matter what, because that's Snyder's vision for these characters. As much as I disagree with it, that's kind of the movie that he was already leaning towards, and it's hardly even surprising.
Wolverine 3.
What I expect to happen after Deadpool's success is a Youngblood movie, which has been rumored for years and has wound up in a bunch of different hands. Rob Liefeld getting more of his characters that he's got ownership of getting out there and getting in production, just in the same way that happened to Frank Miller. When Miller's stuff, one thing hit, then everything else Frank Miller started getting made. And they let him direct the Spirit. Oh, God! But be that as it may, we haven't really seen the effects of Deadpool on other movies yet. Do I think it's coming? Sure. Absolutely. Am I super worried about it? No, because the kinds of movies that those are probably going to be are not the kinds of characters that I was even that interested in to begin with. I don't think Fox themselves are looking to make the X-Men movies jump over to that R-rated thing. If anything, Wolverine. I don't like that, but I'm not a huge fan of the character, and I kind of understand that people have been begging for an R-rated Wolverine anyways. Are they going to suddenly do a TNA version of Jubilee? Probably not. Are they going to do I Want Your Sex Spider-Man somewhere? Probably not. Marvel's already said that R-rated films aren't in the future for their movies. What they have, before Deadpool happened, kind of gone outside what a lot of people expected with their characters, with what they did with Daredevil, and especially with Jessica Jones. Not crazy over the top, but certainly outside the purview of what we again expected from a Marvel film. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I just, even David Goyer, who's got his hands in the Sandman thing, I don't think he's looking to do that kind of thing with Sandman. I think, yes, the worst fears that I could see be realized is Sandman becoming the equivalent of Pinhead in the Hellraiser series, where he's just kind of like a voiceover guy and he's kind of leading things around, but the story's happening around him and it's a cheesy horror flick. I could definitely see that being the case. And I would feel really bad about that. I would regret that a lot. But that's kind of what I thought was going to happen anyways before Levitt got involved, before anybody really gave a crap. And it was just, oh, they're going to make a Sandman movie. Well, I bet they're not going to make the Sandman movie. I bet it's just going to be one of those things. Because if you're going to make a really great Sandman movie, the first thing you do is you do a really great Death movie and have that lead into Sandman. Because Death, even though it came later, was the entry point for so many people into the Sandman series. It was easily one of the greatest graphic novels for me to go and put into a new reader's hands and say, if you like this, I have a whole extra world that you get to explore after it. But I'm pretty sure, if nothing else, you're going to love this one book. And so if they aren't willing to start there, then I don't know really what they're going to do to make the movie great.
Maybe the passage of The Sound of Her Wings, or what was it called?
Oh.
Where the dream accompanies her while she takes souls to the next place.
Yeah.
That was a good entry point.
I mean, a lot of what makes Sandman great is the whole stuff with the Endless anyways, and that is such a big thing to do. I don't think you can tell a succinct story in one Sandman movie and not have the Endless either established ahead of time or involve them, and it's a slow build to find out about these other characters, this whole family of these creatures, and that's why I think a movie just doesn't stand a chance. Where it really needs to be a series or a series of films, and jumping out with a series of films intent means you're not making a first movie that stands on its own. And so, yeah, it's really a touchy ground.
Okay. So let's shift gears a little bit here, because there's some comic book news that I was doing some little bit of research while you guys were talking that, because again, I don't know too much about Sandman. I came at this more at the Joseph Gordon-Levitt level, because I'm a fan of his. But let's switch gears to two other quick little more quick comic book stories. The first is that Boom Studios announces its first crossover event. This is something I didn't realize that they hadn't happened, but I think they're a fairly young studio to begin with. Like, I think they're only 16 years old or something like that.
Oh, if that. I mean, as far as the Boom Studios as everybody knows them, I mean, right now Boom Studios has already had to reinvent itself completely when they lost a bunch of their licenses to Marvel when DC bought Marvel Comics and moved all their things from Boom over to there. So they started picking up other licenses after that. So the Boom Studios of today now doing more of their own creator-owned stuff and yeah. Doing licensed products and stuff that aren't Muppet-related and aren't some of the other characters that they were doing for a while. This is, I think Darkwing Duck and DuckTales and all mm-hmm. of those things. Just the yeah. fact that Boom was able to stick that out and come out, I think, a much stronger company afterwards is pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, excuse me. So, and this crossover is between their, what I would consider their flagship title with Lumberjanes, and Gotham Academy over at DC. And this, to me, actually screams more about DC's willingness to do crossovers, because this is their third crossover within the past year that they've done. Like, you got the Green Lantern Star Trek series over at IDW or event that they did over at IDW. Same thing with Batman and the Ninja Turtles that's going on right now. Yep. With IDW. And then this one with Boom Studios, and it's a really interesting thing, and it's coming out. It's going to come out at the in June is when the first issue comes, and it'll be written by China Clugston Flores, who wrote Blue Monday, and it will be illustrated by Rosemary Valero O'Connell, who does the art for Lumberjanes now. And I've reading this article, and I'm like, yeah, that's right. And it's going to be a 6-issue crossover series. And I was reading this, and I'm like, okay, yeah, this is actually a great way to describe Lumberjanes, because they start off describing Lumberjanes as Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Gravity Falls. So I'm like, okay, yeah, that's actually a really, really great way to describe it. And the website that we get this from, villagevoice.com, they actually have the first cover. And I don't know if they actually said who did the cover, but they nailed the look of both universes here.
Mingzhu Chen did the full cover.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's a perfect mix of cartoony, kid-friendly, showing personality of the characters. None of the characters look the same. They each look very distinct from each other. You can look at them and kind of get an imagination of what they would sound like, what their personalities are, and it's just perfect. I'm excited about this because Lumberjanes, even though it's from Boom Studios, is at least treated in such a way that it acts like and feels like a creator-owned book.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you're right, it's certainly at a level of like the saga of Boom Studios. It's that level for them. It is a big hit for them. And it's beloved. It's got a huge fan base.
Because this is one of their few original books.
Right.
Which is not to say like, oh, their licensed books aren't good or anything like that, but they're all unique. Like they have the regular show book, Adventure Time. There was, I think, Bean Puppy Cat. What was the name of Bravest Warriors? Mm-hmm. Was over there. Those are all still good.
Those are licenses.
Yeah, but they're licenses. And so there's more for them to do a crossover event with, like, someone over at DC wants to do a crossover event with regular show. There's more, the regular show comic book, there's more hoops to jump through than just going, hey, you want to do this? Hey, yeah, sure, let's do this. And
well, also the opportunity has to be there. And what comics do they have over at DC to do that besides... Yeah. Batmite or Bizarro, which have both already finished their 6-issue series. So while Gotham Academy is not the greatest seller at DC, at least as far as print numbers, we don't really know their digital numbers. It's a beloved book. It's one of those books that is somehow both in continuity yet can exist on its own and reach an audience that is more all ages appropriate than the rest of the main DC line is. And that's perfect for this. It's one of those things that as soon as you see it, you go, holy crap, you know, who came up with this and why didn't I come up with this? As a person who's a fan of the stuff, why wasn't this something that we were already shipping, you know, to put it in a fan fiction service?
Yeah.
Why was not this already being something written by people? And to get China Clugston out of this is fantastic. To get the artist of the actual Lumberjanes book doing it is fantastic. I'd like to see some of the DC creators also involved in it, at least
I would imagine,
some of the storyboarding.
I would imagine that there's going to be a lot of variant covers that have or maybe even like there's some backstories coming up with them that will feature the art styles of the people who do the book over at DC.
And when is this being released as well? Because we're getting close to the time of Rebirth for DC, and this is planning on
coming out in June.
Which is, I think, when Rebirth is supposed to happen as well. So the question is there going to be a Gotham Academy book going on at the same time as this? Or is this essentially the Gotham Academy book for the first 6 months of DC's Rebirth? Which I would be fine with. I would absolutely be fine with that. The whole point is to get eyes onto this book, which should be getting new readers and should be getting attention.
Here's the thing, because of how the... Here's my thinking, because of how the book or the article was titled. And it's making me think that this is more how the Star Trek Spectrum War, Star Trek Green Lantern Spectrum Wars book was, where it was published more through IDW than it was through DC.
And I think that's the case here too.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, it's really funny to think that DC, being the giant publisher that it is, and the, you know, the well-known publisher that it is, stands to benefit more for their book from this crossover by what Lumberjanes audience brings to it than the reverse. Then like, oh, Lumberjanes is going to get a big boost because of this crossover with DC. No, I think in this case, Gotham Academy might be the one that gets more of a boost than Lumberjanes. I think Lumberjanes is doing just fine for itself. So getting the Lumberjanes audience, who maybe weren't really the ones who would pick up a DC title, period, to now say, oh, what is this Gotham Academy book? And, oh, there's a couple of trades that happened that I can read those too. Perfect. You know, I can find out more about these characters. That's a pretty big thing in and of itself. I mean, when Spawn Batman happened, and I say that meaning not Batman Spawn, Spawn was definitely the bigger book at the time. But it's rare to have that kind of situation. You know, when Planetary crossed over with the Justice League, as cool as Planetary was, Justice League was still the bigger title. DC and Marvel having crossovers is something completely different because they're more even playing field. But this is very interesting.
Amalgam Universe and...
Well, I mean, even before that, it goes back to Spider-Man and Superman having crossovers and some of the other ones that they've done. In fact, that's kind of the other thing, too, is with DCU and those titles, like the Batgirl title and Black Canary and some of these other titles that were sort of outside of the DC New 52 universe in feel and look and characterization. This would be such a perfect time and perfect opportunity to have a DC Marvel crossover with some of those characters. To see the Cameron Stewart, Babs Tarr, Batgirl team up with Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel, would be so great, because there's not the dead weight of the usual DC Marvel crossovers. First they have to meet and beat each other up and then go fight the villain and everything else. It's like they could do something really fun and different with it, and it wouldn't be about ego, because they're non-ego characters and non-ego books from non-ego creators. I'm not saying that they don't have egos, but I'm just saying that it's not really what it's all about. It's like, I'm cooler than you are. I'm Brian Michael Bendis, so I write everything Marvel, or I'm Jeff Johns, and here's Jim Lee, and we do everything DC. It's so much different than that, and it's such a great opportunity that could happen that is a missed opportunity, because it won't. Because the people in charge of the companies still are those people. So in maybe the next generation of comics, maybe 10 years or 15 years from now, when the people who are these creators today move up into those types of roles, hopefully some of them do, maybe that's when we start to see this stuff kind of happen again. It's got to be inevitable. It's got to be inevitable that we will eventually get another Marvel-DC crossover. I think it's almost inevitable that we will eventually get a Marvel-DC crossover, either in animation or in film. I think at some point it will happen. If Sony and Marvel can work together to get Spider-Man reintegrated in the Marvel Universe, even in a limited degree, I think at some point it's going to behoove both companies. There was a Roger Rabbit movie that combined Disney and Warner Brothers. I think that this could happen at some point for the DC Marvel films. If the DC films take off and perform at a level that is at least roughly close to equal with the Marvel films and what they've done. And I'm not saying that they won't, but I'm saying Marvel's not going to give a crap about doing a crossover with a company who can't break $1 billion with some of their superhero movies when that's what they're doing semi-consistently.
Yeah. The second or this third news story that I want to hit on quickly because it sounds like you got your wish there, Corey. And that is that the Killing Joke, because it's actually the clip was played recently, actually, on one of the podcasts, I think it was on Variant, of Grant Morrison stating how The Killing Joke was never supposed to be continuity. It was supposed to be an Elseworlds book.
Alan Moore.
I thought it was Grant Morrison that said it about, or with him talking to.
Well, Alan Moore has said that.
Yeah. And then it got brought into continuity because of the whole thing, but there was a problem in the fact that Batman killed the Joker.
It's heavily implied. It's one of those things that people have argued back and forth, mostly argued in the favor of, yes, Batman killed the Joker at the end of this book.
Yeah.
But it's never really so blatantly stated.
Mm-hmm.
But everything about the Killing Joke happened outside of continuity, and it's obvious from other things in the book. There are pictures in the book of characters that didn't exist in the DC continuity at that point in time. Like, Batman's looking at pictures of the past, and there's Batwoman in there, the Kathy Kane Batwoman. She did not exist in this post-crisis world. Mm-hmm. Barbara Gordon was 40 years old, was taking care of her retired father, Jim Gordon, when the Joker shot her. But Barbara Gordon was still ever youthful and vibrant in the regular DC universe at that point in time. She wasn't a dowdy librarian like they portrayed her in this. So this was something that happened years later, much in the way that The Dark Knight Returns did.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is it proved so popular that they were just like, okay, that's what happened. You know, we're going to run with some of the things, except for the Joker actually being dead. The rest of the stuff, they just decided to treat it as continuity. So they didn't use Barbara at all for years. And when they finally brought her back, when someone finally thought, whatever happened to Barbara Gordon? Oh, well, she got shot. What do you mean she got shot? Oh, it was in The Killing Joke. But I didn't think that was continuity. Oh, well, yeah, she's shot. She can't walk anymore. Well, let's see what we can do about that. And that was Ostrander in Suicide Squad, using her behind the scenes as Oracle, gave her a brand new identity and stuff, which is great, you know, making something good out of what was, again, a situation that wasn't even intended to be that impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Moore wrote The Killing Joke like he wrote Watchmen. He was writing Watchmen with the characters that were Blue Beetle and Captain Atom and Peacemaker. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, I can't use those characters, so I'll just rename them, make them these things. We'll have Night Owl and Rorschach and stuff. But he wasn't writing it to rewrite what was, or to break the toys of DC Comics. That wasn't what his intention was. But that's what the story turned out to be.
Yeah.
And that led into the 90s, where everything was very grimdark, and people would just get killed left and right or broken. And at some point, it was like, well, we got to break all these toys, but someone has to think about bringing them back. So we'll kill Superman, but then we'll introduce four new Supermen, and then a year or so down the road, we'll bring Superman back to life. And we'll break Batman's back, and then we'll have a new Batman all heavily armored up who will fight the guy who broke Batman's back, but then we got to bring Bruce Wayne back because he's still Batman. Wonder Woman got changed, lost being Wonder Woman, and had to run around in some really bad outfit for a while when another Amazon took her place in the role. Marvel did a lot of the same things, introduced sidekick characters that took over the parts of their counterparts. So War Machine for a while was Iron Man. Well, Rhodey became Iron Man and then later on became War Machine. And there was a new guy who became Thor, and then he became Thunderstrike. And there was a new guy who became Captain America and then went back to become U.S. Agent. So it was a bad time for comics, and a lot of that came out of the fact that the most popular stories in that era were The Killing Joke, Dark Knight Returns, Watchmen. And DC especially has been beholden to those stories and those essentially two writers for 30 years since then, which is crazy to me that, you know, 30 years of hinging everything on what was a couple of storylines and Crisis. Like, how many times have retold Crisis in one way or another in that 30 years? It's just so strange, especially when Alan Moore doesn't want anything to do with DC anymore and hasn't for the last over a decade. Left doing comics that he was doing with Wildstorm because Wildstorm got bought out by DC, and he's like, well, fuck you guys for doing this and putting me in this position. And Jim Lee's like, well, don't worry about it because you're still going to be left on your own and everything that you do is going to be your thing. And then slowly DC started saying, oh, that ad you wanted to put in the back of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? Yeah, you don't get to put that ad in there. Well, big fuck you to you, DC. I'm out. And so all this great stuff he was doing with America's Best Comics, yeah, it started going to other creators instead.
So all that, we have all that backstory for... And the main part of that was the biggest part of the Killing Joke that became continuity was the fact of Barbara Gordon getting shot.
And according to one editor's wording, go ahead, cripple the bitch.
Yeah. And so then they have more retconning after they bring her in as Oracle. But they're like, but wait a minute, she used to be Batgirl. And so now, and then they brought her back as Batgirl through various means that I think they've done. I know with this current version, it's a cybernetic implant, or is it? I am foretelling. Because, and this is actually spoiling the book I haven't read yet. I am still 4 issues behind on the books that I read from 2 weeks ago. So the last week of February, I guess I got 4 books from there. And then I have all 22 books, which is actually light for me, from this week, or from this past week. And one of them is Batgirl number 49, in which they state that, and I had this, I knew this going up into it, but I didn't realize they were going to do this exactly, where they, basically Barbara Gordon is fighting someone who is messing with her mind. Because the other power that she's had is she has a photographic memory. But what do you do with a villain who's messing with your memories? Who is taking out and inputting other memories? You know, removing true ones and inputting real ones or fake ones. And they call the character the Fuge, F-U-G-U-E. And turns out one of them fake memories was being shot by the Joker. And that whole thing, so sort of just went, hey, yeah, you know how you guys wanted to cripple the bitch? Well, guess what? And actually, I'm just gonna do this because this is the photo that Babs Tarr tweeted, and I love it. Right there. Just good old, I believe that's from Spider-Man. Actually.
It's from Spider-Man 3. It is the least beloved Peter Parker ever, and I'm including the Clone Saga.
Yeah.
I do not necessarily think that is a great thing to lead with if you're trying to get comic fans on your side over something.
But here's what she said. We undid some things with that photo.
Yes.
And it's more the look. It's more the look. You know, it's him sitting there looking all coy like, oh, we gone done did something here now. And then it's revealed, hey, you know, we changed this. Because they do it all the time. Comics, if you don't like something with comics, give it 3 months. It'll change. Sort of deal. Oh, you don't like the fact that Batman died at the end of Endgame? Well, hey, give it a year and he'll be back like he is now.
Yeah, I mean, here's where, I mean, I've seen a lot of people blow up about this today. And oh, it's evidence of social justice warriors, and you can't do anything harmful to a female or a person of color in comics anymore, and blah, blah. And first of all, you know, choke on a lot of dicks because you're a fucking moron if that's what you think this is about. No, here's the thing about comics. Like I said, Killing Joke is 30 years old. It's a 30-year-old story. Should everything that happens in comics today be beholden to a 30-year-old story? Now, you can say yes, because if you go to the origins of characters and you say, should everything in Superman today be beholden to the fact that he was a young boy rocketed to Earth from exploding planet Krypton, who landed on a farm in Kansas and was raised by the Clark, by the Kents there, to be a upstanding young human person who then went to Metropolis and became a reporter and fought crime as Superman. Yeah, okay, yeah, you probably should be beholden to that, because that's who the character is. Is the Killing Joke the defining character of Barbara Gordon? It's a story that's not even about her. She's crippled in a way to torture her father, and the reason why her father is being tortured is to get at Batman. So she is tertiary to the story that ruins her life, essentially.
And honestly, I think that's what Cameron Fletcher, Bab Starr, you know, all the, you know, the creatives behind the book right now thought about. You know, they probably sat there and went, well, wait a minute, everyone loves the Killing Joke, and I'm not saying that they don't love the book. You know, I have respect for the book. It's not like I understand why everyone loves it, but it's a good Elseworlds book. It's a great Elseworlds book.
It's an Elseworlds book. I've never been a huge fan of it, partly because of how they treated Barbara in it.
Yeah.
And honestly, I'm not the biggest Moore fan in the world, and I always preface things that I talk about with his stuff is like,
yeah,
I don't love his stuff in the way that other people seem to. But I get it. I understand.
But here's my problem with it. If you're going to consider it canon, then why is it that, and I'm sort of echoing your point here, why is it that the only character in that book that it seems like remembers it or really even truly acknowledges it is a tertiary character, is Barbara Gordon?
Right. That's a very good point. There's a couple of things to look at here. One is that you're absolutely correct. The only effect that's felt from the Killing Joke in everything else is that Barbara Gordon was crippled by the Joker in it. Two, it happened 30 years ago, but in that time, we got to develop Barbara into a completely different character. We got to develop her into Oracle. She became a stronger character. She made a choice to not have her legs start working again because she said it felt unfair that she gets an advantage being that she works with all these essentially gods, these superpower people who can do this, but every other person out there doesn't have that same opportunity. You know, and it's always looked at as kind of ridiculous. It's like Barbara Gordon can't walk, but Batman's had his back broken and came back from it and is Batman again. You know, not just he can walk again, but he's out there kicking ass every night. Cyborg has had his entire body replaced with parts from, I don't know, GM. There's all these different things that kind of point at and go, like, why is Barbara the only one who's not walking now? Mm-hmm. And they've explored that. But at the same time they've explored that, they've given all these other examples of how she's a much stronger character than she was ever portrayed as Batgirl. Running Birds of Prey, doing the things that she's done, outsmarting the Calculator, who is a very good antithesis character for her. All these great things that happened over years and years of time by creators basically saying, okay, this is where we're stuck, but we think the character deserves better, so we're going to give her better.
Mm-hmm.
All of that happened, and that's great, and that's why a lot of people love the Oracle version of the character. But DC, for better or worse, did Flashpoint and did the New 52. The New 52 was a potential to restart all of these stories. They completely started over with Superman. They did not completely start over with Batman, but for a lot of extra Batman characters, they did. So, spoiler, was never Robin, was never Batgirl. Cassandra Cain was never Batgirl. All of these characters that were in somehow in these Batman stories that seemingly existed didn't happen anymore. Yet there's still four Robins, all boys, black hair, strange as that is. Death in the Family sort of happened maybe to Jason Todd, but not quite the same. But for some reason or another, in this new continuity where they're doing away with there being an Oracle character, Barbara Gordon still got shot and paralyzed for some period of time.
And I think there's even still, and I think even in this, which is where I'm sort of getting more and more excited about the Rebirth store event or whatever it's going to happen, new numbering, as long as they don't truly mess with some great or, you know, cancel some great books done by great writers. I'm looking at Harley Quinn, Starfire. I could go on and on, but...
Starfire is already canceled.
Why you do this?
I just tell you how it is, buddy.
But you know, as long as they don't cancel the Harley Quinn book,
there is no way in hell they're canceling the Harley Quinn book. It's their second bestseller.
Yeah, or you know, these other great books that aren't, or is okay. So if they're canceling the Starfire book, at least that there is something that's going to replace it, written by Amanda Conner and Jimmy Palmiotti, that's just as good, you know, sort of deal. That's the main point I'm getting at with this, not the fact that you just rained on my parade of, oh, hey, they canceled Starfire. But, you know, that's not the typical, oh, we got to have this dark Batman and this Superman that's more lighter and all this other stuff, but not light in, like, the ha-ha way, light in the fact that he's still kicking ass and taking names. It's just he's not all brooding and serious all the time sort of thing. But with Rebirth, we could truly have with some of these characters, not necessarily a full rebirth or maybe even rebirth, but a rebirth into the old, you know, to where you can truly acknowledge that, you know, this person had this and that and whatever, that you can acknowledge the fact of Cassandra Cain and Spoiler, who weren't acknowledged until the Batman Eternal and Batman and Robin Eternal books sort of deal. And even then, it's just sort of like they're here in as side characters in like Catwoman or the Batgirl book. And it's like nothing ever really happened with them. I'm glad for this. And I'm probably when we get done here, I'm going to read, you know, I'm going to like, okay, hold up. The four books, you can wait. I'm reading Batgirl right when we get done. Sort of deal. So I'm going to pour some salt in your wounds here, Corey, and talk about a movie that you're jealous that I saw. And that's Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And this, because apparently you didn't realize it was on HBO.
I did not. Time is not my time. TV time is split up between one, a couple of shows here, and two, you know, I've got a wife who also gets to watch the TV.
Yeah. But this is one, and I said this in the pre-show, not exactly great to watch after, like, within a week after you've been in a car accident, because you start to get a little, especially when you had a couple times where you just sort of broke down after the car accident. Not like, but like physically sobbing. It's more like you're still trying to be. I don't want to say tough, but I'm not wanting to go full on like ugly cry. But I was crying, and then watching this, and you get to the end, and I'm like, oh, you assholes, ah, oh, such a touching moment. And here come the tears. Just do it. No one's around to see you cry.
It got you when you were emotionally vulnerable.
Exactly. But it's a great story.
Which means you'd be the perfect prom date.
But no, it's a great story. It's one part a Wes Anderson movie, three parts the Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Which is a movie that I really, really loved, which is why I wanted to see this one so bad, because it looked evocative of that.
Mm-hmm. It has that style, you know, similar tone to Perks, but at the same time, because one of the things I love is you have the main character, Greg, And his business partner, as he calls him, Earl, they make movies, but they just don't do like the Adam Goldberg on the Goldbergs, like let's just do a shot for shot remake of the Transformers animated movie or Risky Business or whatever.
Or they Please Be Kind Rewind.
Yeah. Or they change one of the like a couple letters in the title to make a new movie. So instead of A Clockwork Orange, they have A Sockwork Orange, in which they use sock puppets as, and you only see like one scene, but it's just the three sock puppets come up, and I'm assuming it's the beginning of the movie, and I'm like, that's good. Or, oh gosh, there was a few other ones. But
well, don't give them all away. Let's let people. No,
but they had, you know, these great, like, oh, here's this one, and it's like, oh, Senior Citizen Kane is another one that you see a couple times, and it's like, all right, this is cool. And it has this quality to it that you're like, okay, this looks homemade, but then at the same time, it's like, but they know what they're doing when they're doing this. That's just sort of the background on the Greg and the and Earl. Another thing that I didn't realize is the guest stars, the lesser characters, the secondary characters, and the actors who play them. Like Nick Offerman plays the dad. Molly Shannon plays the dying girl's mom. Wolverine has a cameo.
I heard that.
And I'm like,
is he just stapled onto somebody's face?
No, someone's wall.
Okay, there you go.
But no, it's like I'm sitting there going, that's Hugh Jackman. How the hell did they get Hugh Jackman?
As I was expressing to somebody at work today, Hugh Jackman is a national treasure.
Exactly.
Somebody's nation.
He's an Australian national treasure.
Right.
Sounds like a movie that would be starring Nicolas Cage. We gotta go find the Australian National Book of Independence, or whatever.
It's a Wolverine comic.
Yeah,
I had three of these before I got married to Elvis Presley.
And then John Bernthal is in here too. Like straight off of, I think it might have been straight off of his death on Walking Dead or something like that. And his character is actually great. He plays a history teacher. But it's like, you know, one of the teachers where he always wears the short sleeve shirts and he's got all these tats all over. And I'm like, all right, yeah, you are really cool. Or he's not history. He's like a philosophy teacher or something, but they're in high school. Because he's a well-traveled person. And it's just cool to see these kids go through. And it's all told through Greg's perspective. He narrates the movie. As he goes, there's moments that are really enjoyable, and I to say anything more about him would be to spoil him, in a way. But the ending is great. I love the ending. Like, and again, it is one of those. If you're in a vulnerable spot, it'll hit you in the dick. But yeah, it's well worth the watch. You can find it right now on HBO, either on HBO Go now, go to your on demand section, and if you have HBO and get it that way.
I really thought you were gonna say turn to your partner, and we were gonna HBO do-si-do.
Is that like Netflix and chill?
Yeah, exactly.
But no, so excuse me. But yeah, so that is that. Mural and the Dying Girl. The next one is one that I just watched the third episode, and that's the one that you want to talk about here, The Real O'Neills. What did you think? Because I have some comparisons to compare it to. I want to see if you would agree with it.
Well, I'm sure that it compares to a lot of things, but the point is, overall, it compared, at least for me and Aaron, incredibly favorably.
No, they're really good comparisons, but...
Yeah, just... I mean, I kept seeing commercials for it, and I thought, okay, that looks okay, and obviously it's got, why can I not think of her name, the mom from Raising Hope, who is terrific in all things that,
honestly. And two kids' TV stars. Martha Plimpton is her name.
Yeah. But
the older brother and then the sister were both
The sister is from the New Normal.
Well, yeah, she was on the New Normal too, but she was before that. She was on iCarly.
Well, that's not a TV star to me. And the older brother was...
I want to say he was on a Disney Channel show as well, but he was on Nickelodeon show.
Why are you wasting my time with this? God damn it.
He was on a Nickelodeon show, True Jackson VP with Keke Palmer.
I don't know who any of those people are.
True Jackson VP is the name of the show, which also starred Greg Proops, by the way. And then Keke Palmer is the black girl on Scream Queens.
So what you're just telling me is I got to feel really sad for Greg Proops.
No, yeah, you could put it that way. So the real O'Neill's for me, you could compare it almost to Raising Hope or My Name Is Earl. In a way,
My Name Is Earl maybe to a certain degree. The way that it kind of follows the story along from episode to episode, I guess I can see that. It certainly had a feel of it belongs right with the Goldbergs, which I think it was surrounding the night that it premiered. Unfortunately, they're moving it to a different night.
Yeah, it's on Tuesdays. It's replacing the Muppets, because I guess the Muppets had a shorter season. The Muppets wrapped up last week, and so this is taking its place. And that's the other part. And it was, I don't know if you'd call it a detriment or not, but it seemed like this was a show that would be taking place in the early to mid 90s with everything I've seen with the ads.
It didn't necessarily feel like a modern time show, but it obviously it is. It's just like the mom has a really old fashioned attitude towards things.
Yeah, like even this third episode, which is all about Lent, and stuff like that. I'm like, oh yeah, this isn't a let's go back in time like Fresh Off the Boat or the Goldbergs, or there was another one I think that did it that was on there. But like those shows, but let's just be modern in a way and talk about, and it seems like just talk about how, you know, the Irish Catholics are in Chicago in a way.
Yeah, but I also like that it plays with the absurd. From the moment when he's sitting at the dinner table and he winds up talking to Jesus in the opening scene, and then later on when he's trying to convince himself to have sex with his girlfriend, and he starts talking to the shirtless male model in the mirror, I was just, this is great. This is way, way more off the wall than I expected it to be from the commercials.
I wouldn't be surprised if the Jesus character becomes a recurring character. Like, you just see him, because he's in episode 3.
Well, better him than Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah.
It was like when I felt, we're trying to involve Jimmy Kimmel because he's on the network and stuff. Yeah. Not that I don't like Jimmy Kimmel, but we get it.
Yeah, it's great. I love this show.
Your kids are liking Fallon. You're not a Jimmy Kimmel fan.
No, I'm Fallon.
Yes. I'm Fallon, okay. But I thought it was incredibly cute, and again we were surprised at how funny we thought it was. We went in there with very low expectations, and they were certainly elevated by what we got in the 2 half-hour episodes that we've seen so far.
Yeah, and I mean even the pilot didn't scream super pilot-y to me.
Right.
Like it seemed like we were just in the middle of the show. Like yeah, they did set up the premise like, oh, the older brother's anorexic. The sister's a thief.
The sister is terrific.
Yeah,
the sister really is amazing.
Like she's like some con artist thief type character, and then he's gay, and they're going through a divorce and all this stuff.
The girlfriend I really like too. I hope that she at least gets to stick around as a semi recurring character because she was a lot of fun.
She was, but now you just set my plan back a whole 5 years.
Yeah.
But no, it's really enjoyable. It airs for everyone who watches our show later. It airs Tuesday nights at 8:30 on ABC right after Fresh Off the Boat and right before Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So let's jump ship to, let's stay on the network. Let's talk Agent Carter.
And yeah, while we still can.
Yeah, while we, because, well, let's start with this. Would you want a season 3?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I know that this season was not the knock my socks off season that the first season was, but I still think it's a lot of fun, has a lot to explore. But where it really was, it proved to me again, oh my God, I love this show, was in the episode when they started up doing a musical.
Oh, yeah. Because see, here, I felt like this whole season was very much like a Marvel comic event book, where we get to issue 8 of 8, or 8 of 9, and then it's like, oh, hey, we got to start wrapping things up. And that's sort of how it felt with this season. Like, they were still building out of the 8 episodes that they had. I think it was 8 episodes. They were still building by episode 7.
Yeah, I will say, the thing with these two ABC-run Marvel shows is that they go through a lot of jumps in the story from the beginning of the season to the end of the season, or at least until the end of the mid-season. They go through a lot of jumps where characters change, characters die, the storyline chooses to follow a different path than where you started. So, I mean, it's not dull, but it is kind of like, are they just making this up as they go along, or do they have a final point that they're actually working towards, and do they know that when they start? And that is what I feel is probably the weak point of both this and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., is that it just doesn't quite click in the way that the whole storyline makes sense and progresses in a way that makes sense. But I find the characters and the actors so entertaining on this that I feel like when they get to their groove on a character, and when they have them start interacting more with each other, it gets to be a great show. But it takes a while to get to those moments. And that's a little frustrating.
Yeah. I did enjoy the show. I only ask the question of, do you think it should get a season 3? Because of that fact that it took, you know, the first 7 episodes to build to the climax. And it did seem like they wrapped up quite a bit, but they did leave open the questions with the Chad Michael Murray's character biting the bullet.
We assume.
Yeah, we assume. But I don't know, because it makes me wonder, okay, how are they going to relate it to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Because every season so far has related, they've related them back and forth.
Well, isn't all the Dark Matter stuff relate in some way to opening up the portals and everything?
That would be my guess, is that this is the same thing as that stone.
That's what it felt like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, if this has to rely on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to tell it where it starts and where it ends with its storyline, maybe that's part of the reason why it wasn't as strong as it could have been, because it's got to write around what they want. And I just want Agent Carter to be its own thing. I loved the idea of it being a spy show set in the time of the 50s spies, which was the gadgetry and the kind of like total super spy disguises and everything else that they were doing. I really love that part. I love when she gets to go into different personas, puts on a wig and plays a different character, uses different accents. because it shows off her talent so much. She is such a talented actress that she should be playing in a role much like the lead actress from Orphan Black does.
Yeah.
And I think that they're underutilizing her in the material. That's the thing about Orphan Black is that Tatyana, right? Tatyana?
Yeah, Tatyana Maslany.
She is getting so much to work with to show her talent. And I think that Atwell is not being showcased as well as she could be. And I think that that's what people want. That's what the fans want. They came to watch a show because of Agent Carter. You know, they didn't come to watch it to see Howard Stark, although I think that there are times when he's utilized and he's a lot of fun. You know, I think maybe he was a little underutilized this season. They aren't necessarily watching it for Jarvis, but Jarvis is a good addition to it. But when you add in everything else and all these other secondary, tertiary, whatever area comes after that, for these other characters and storylines, like the whole thing with her boss being a potential love interest, he starting out being engaged to this other nurse, and then she just kind of says, oh, I think you're in love with Agent Carter, bye, and disappears halfway through the season, that feels a little false, and it feels a little tacked on and unnecessary. Yeah. Beatmaster is saying, did they really have to focus so much on her not being able to choose between her love interests? Yeah, again, it's okay to have her have a love interest, because she didn't really do that in the first season. She was still, in a lot of ways, pining for Steve, but it didn't lead her character. You know, she felt protective of his blood, she felt protective of him, and she felt still that sort of loss of him not being there anymore, but it wasn't what she was all about. And in this season, it maybe was a little bit more of that. And I don't think that's what we want from our Agent Carter. You know, I'm not against her having a love story, I'm not against her having a love interest, but she should be able to do things that are much more fun and interesting than that. And let people pine for her. Let people be pursuing her, not her kind of having to choose between them. You know, she has got her shit together. You know, let them kind of be the ones who are like, but what about me? Well, first, I've got to deal with this stuff over here. So get in line, and we'll talk later when all this other stuff is done. And so I think that may be one of the misfires this season, too.
Yeah.
So, I loved Jarvis's wife, though.
No, yeah. I absolutely did. I loved that this season it seemed like Jarvis was more the comedic relief. Like
I think he was in the first season, too.
But I think even a little bit more so, because this season, or the first season, it seemed like it was more like he has a stick up his ass comic relief. And then this season, it was more he was ready for the adventure and all this stuff. And then, oh, funny things just sort of happened to him.
Beatmaster saying Jarvis gained the most as a character this season. I agree. Mm-hmm. Getting him some backstory, meeting his wife, the moment of where we realize that his adventuring caused his wife harm, where he has to deal with that, and he suddenly feels the weight of, like, I've been playing this role with Agent Carter instead of paying all the attention I should to my wife, and I wasn't here to protect her, and how he took that his character got to be explored more in that way. The villainess of the season, I liked her potential. I think, again, they spent more time dealing with her and her relationships to men than I felt was worthwhile. I really liked Dottie more in the first season because she wasn't beholden to any of that stuff. Although they did kind of make it seem like a lot of the stuff she did was as a revenge against Howard Stark for, you know, screwing around with her and then tossing her aside like he does. Too much weight on the men in relation to the female characters in the show between this season and the end of last season. So that bugs me a little bit, because as much as they say the show should be about female empowerment, and it should, and I'm perfectly okay with that, they kind of undermine it with those moments.
No, yeah, exactly. So I think we're gonna call it.
Yeah.
We'll save the other shows. And actually, it works great for me with Cuckoo because I want to get more episodes in before I give a review of it. So all that's left to say is you can check out our webpage at elsinors.com where you can find the both the audio and video versions of our show. Basically, meaning I gotta get off my butt and do the audio versions. You could like our Facebook group page at facebook.elsinors.com, and you could see full archives of our shows, including the past incarnations like what we're watching weekly. Over at watch.elsners.com, and we record the Elsners show every Monday night-ish at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Western, 2:30, which will change next week thanks to daylight savings time.
Stupid idea.
Yeah. And, hey, you've probably...
Uh-oh. Gregor, freeze for everybody else?
Did I freeze?
You did for me. I'm sorry, man. I couldn't tell if it was me or everybody.
Okay. Where did I leave off?
All I heard was, and hey, digital. Okay. So I was going to go for it for you.
Yeah, the Galactic Netcasts. I should probably tell Mom to quit torrenting stuff or whatever she's doing.
Mom, God damn it. We're not going to need to get Star Wars. It'll be out on DVD next month. Exactly. Yeah, so, hey, we are somewhat affiliated with Galactic Netcasts, some of us more than others at the moment, and we think you should check them out. If you don't already, you can go to gncast.com, and you can see all the podcasts they do there, including Sci-Fi Geeks Club, Podcast of Terror, Adventure Party, Alien Invasion Podcast, which does really well in downloads, pretty kind of spectacular, Who News and Reviews when it's happening, Sci-Fi Survival Guide at other times... there's a lot of great stuff there. You should check them out.
Weird World Weekly.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, let's not mention your other co-host's other show.
Man, no, he's on my time now.
but no, yeah, so it's all over at gncasts.com. That's gncasts.com. And the only thing I have to say is this has been a Don't Tell Glenn production, and we will see you guys next time.
Take care, everybody.